Okay, turn to the where it says Buddhism, and underneath it says introduction. That page will start there. And so Buddhism began in India about 500 BC, and at this point, many Hindus were disillusioned with Hinduism. Many different groups or branches arose from Hinduism, and the most famous offshoot of Hinduism is Buddhism. Probably the second most famous would be Jainism. But Buddhism denies the authority of the Vedas, and I think that's because the, if I remember correctly, within the Vedas, is kind of spells out the caste system and all. But Buddhism was a reform movement which opposed the caste system and a strong Hindu priesthood. So it opposed the corrupt priesthood and evil caste system. So you could actually see similarities between Christ and Buddha here, in that Jesus was opposing a corrupt priesthood, and Jesus was also opposing the wealthy religious leaders oppressing the poor. Now, we can get into all kinds of heresies if we make those two things the primary thrust of Jesus' ministry. Primary thrust of Jesus' ministry was that he happened to be God the Son, and he came to save mankind from our sins. But you can see some similarities there. Now, the history, there's a lot of legend involved, so I'm going to try to cover as much of this as I can without the legendary aspects. And so I'm not going to talk about Hindu being born to an elephant or things like that. They all kinds of weird stuff. But it does seem to be, I think most scholars would accept that this is somewhat accurate, though there might be some exaggeration. The history of Buddhism was founded by Siddhartha Gautama. That's Buddha's real name. Buddha just means the enlightened one, okay? So it's kind of like Jesus Christ. Well, Jesus is his real name, Jesus of Nazareth, and Christ means he's the Messiah. So Siddhartha Gautama became known as Buddha when he found enlightenment, supposedly. Born about 560 BC in northeast India, was the son of a ruler, was raised like a prince. He was married and had a son. Supposedly he lived a sheltered life of comfort in a palace. And then one day he left the palace to see the outside world, and he saw four passing sights. He saw a decrepit old man. That's when he learned about old age. So supposedly he had never seen old people. Now, I don't care if you're raised in a palace, you're going to see old people. So this is kind of an exaggeration here. He saw a decrepit old man, and he learned, okay, the old age. He saw a sickly man, okay, sickness. A funeral procession, he saw death. I doubt he was so sheltered that he didn't even know death existed. But it's kind of like things that the way I see it is that things that he knew were true weren't really emphasized. He was so sheltered from it. But now he starts to see old age, sickness, death, a monk begging for food, and so hunger and poverty. So the overall thing is that he leaves the palace and he finds out, man, this world is not all about comfort like I've got in the palace. It's all about suffering. And to say anything different is just to ignore reality. So, you know, he returned to the palace, but then at another time, one night, he left the palace and his family to seek enlightenment. So, first thing you got to recognize there is Buddha himself was a deadbeat dad. I mean, just like, you know, I'm just going to abandon my wife and kid. And he reached nirvana, supposedly, during a deep state of meditation Eastern meditation under a fig tree. That's when he became the Buddha. Buddha means the enlightened one. Nirvana was the highest degree. This is weird. The highest degree of God consciousness, the cessation of all desire. Yet Buddha really didn't believe in God, so even that's a misleading title. It's kind of just the highest level of consciousness, but he means it in a kind of a spiritual sense. So the term God consciousness seems to be the best way to describe it, even though he really didn't believe in God. But it was the cessation of all desire. And so he decided to spread the truth that he learned. And the truth that he learned was the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Now, he died when he was 80 years of age. By then, his teachings were widely known in India. Now, centuries after his death, Buddha was deified by some of his followers, turned into a god to be venerated or worshipped. But he himself was agnostic. He thought that he wasn't sure that God existed. He didn't think we could know if God existed, and he didn't even think God was relevant. If God existed, he's not relevant. All that's relevant is for us to stop suffering and to attain nirvana. Now, Theravada Buddhism is early Buddhism, mostly in India, whereas Mahayana Buddhism is later Buddhism, mostly in China and Japan. Now, keep in mind, the deification of Buddha happened centuries after his death. That's the way legends take that long. That's unlike Jesus, who actually claimed to be God. Now, Bart Ehrman, the leading anti-Christian New Testament scholar, he is now going out of his way to try to argue that Jesus never claimed to be God and was deified by his followers. Problem is, he doesn't have centuries for a legend like that to develop. He doesn't even have decades. He acknowledges that Paul taught of Jesus being divine in some sense. So he's got his work cut out for him. I mean, we got ancient creeds attributing deity to Jesus in the early 30s AD. So there's a lot more. You want to explain away Christ deity, you got a lot more work to do than you would trying to explain away Buddha's supposed deity. Okay, the main way to understand Buddhist teachings is through the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And so let's look at the Four Noble Truths. These are the things that Buddha learned when he left the palace, okay? The first is the existence of suffering. Okay. And by the way, a religion stands, or a worldview stands or falls, based on how well it offers a solution to suffering. Okay? Atheism is kind of a forfeiting, getting out of the game. You're just saying, well, just suffering just is, just accept it, you know, enjoy your time on this earth, and then leave, because you just cease to exist afterwards. In the end, the whole universe is going to blow up. But in reality, most people know that, you know, if that's the case, if in the end we face nothing but non-existence, and suffering wins, then why even get up in the morning? So most people, I think, are too reasonable to be atheist. To live for something means you got to have something to live for. And atheism says, well, there's nothing to live for, but live for it anyway. And so most of the strength of religion is how well it deals with the issue of suffering. It's just that right now we're so good on diverting our attention from things like death and suffering that we just kind of amuse ourselves to death. And so that's what amusement parks are you know, all about. And you know, when you amuse, you think. And amusement parks mean, you know, turn your brains off and just enjoy the rides, you know. And I'm not saying it's wrong to go to an amusement park, but just keep in mind, if your whole life is an amusement park, just living to be entertained and living from one pleasure to another, whether it's from video games or computer games or movies or sports or whatever it is, you're not really dealing with the fact that life is filled with suffering, okay? I would actually argue that, I mean, we talked about Jewish philosophy in the Jewish wisdom books. Philosophy means the love of wisdom. Well, with Job, the first book, what do you get? You get life. It's suffering. So I would argue that Buddha got the first one right, man. You can't understand reality, can't understand life unless you realize that life is suffering. But what did Job do when he was suffering? He dropped to his knees and worshiped God. And that's why the next Jewish wisdom book, Psalms, it's all about worship. So life is suffering. So what do? We ought to fill our life with worship of God. And then with Proverbs, life is wisdom. You worship God, receive wisdom from God, apply it to daily living. Ecclesiastes tells us that everything under the sun is meaningless. But when everything under the sun, you're not putting God in the equation. You put God in the equation, and then life becomes meaningful. So life is meaningful with God in the equation. Okay? And then the Song of Solomon, life is love. And even the marriage between a man and a woman is just a parable or a type of the relationship between Christ and His church. And so you can see where Jewish wisdom starts right where Buddha starts. It just, Buddha goes off track after that. But, you know, I mean, there'd be no sense for God to write a book if it wasn't for Genesis 3. Mankind falling in the garden and then suffering and death coming into existence because of man's sin. So Buddha's identifying the problem, but then his solution is what really suffers. So you have the existence of suffering and then the cause of suffering. Our desire for pleasures of the senses . Now I'm giving Buddhism the benefit of the doubt here, because to attain nirvana you have to attain a level where you cease to desire. Okay? But if that means all desire, then nirvana is a contradiction. Because you have to desire nirvana. But if nirvana is a cessation of desire, you haven't ceased to desire. How can you stop desiring if you have to keep desiring nirvana? And so, there's a debate among some Buddhists about whether it's all desire or just the desire of the senses. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. If it's all desire, then desiring nirvana is part of the problem. It's not the solution. Okay? It's just the contrary. Stop all desiring. How do you do that? Well, you have to desire nirvana. That would be a contradiction there. And so then we extinguish or end our craving, our desires. Extinguish our desiring will end suffering. Okay? Now we would say, from the Judeo-Christian worldview, the cause of suffering is mankind's broken relationship with God. And therefore, we can end suffering by restoring our broken relationship with God. And that can only be by God's grace alone, through faith alone, and Jesus alone. So you can see where, after point one, Buddha goes downhill. And so we extinguish our desiring. We can end suffering by extinguishing our desiring. And then number four. Extinguish our desiring. Through the Eightfold Path.
Why do that? Why not just get to the end until you find out life and close the back?
Yeah.
Completely free of the desire, just go and do it alone.
Yeah. The only thing Buddhists would say, but then you'd be reincarnated because you still haven't attained nirvana. And I suppose you could just keep doing that. Yeah. Well, but then you'd still be reincarnated. Well, I see what you're saying. Artificially extinguish all your desires, be in a comatose state. You know, it's really interesting too, because that's their goal. Their goal is such a cessation of desire that it really can't be explained as eternal conscious existence. Sometimes they refer to it as eternal unconscious existence. And Buddhist scholars have had a difficult time responding to atheists who say, what's the difference between eternal unconscious existence and no existence at all? And it's really, you know, because Buddhists describe nirvana, the attainment of nirvana, as putting out of the flame. And so it's kind of like the saying that you have stopped desiring, kind of like Blake alluded to. The way they're viewing the total cessation of desire is kind of the total cessation of any rational thought and any consciousness of your existence. And it's almost like there's some people who just think, you know what, I don't believe in life after death, and it freaks me out to die and then go into nothingness and not exist anymore. And then atheists just act like, yeah, it's not that big of a deal. Just live it up down here. Well, that's not consistent. The first view was total nothingness would be terrifying. And with the Buddhists, it's kind of like they're celebrating and embracing the movement towards nothingness, you know. And it's just... I was telling Blake before he came in here that there was this on the so-called Christian station, which, you know, probably 20% of their programs actually are Christian. But on the Christian station, they had these young, five or six young missionaries. They're a different kind of missionary. They go to different countries and live there for 6 months to a year, get to know the culture and stuff. They wouldn't learn the language real well, you know, do the best they could. But as they learned about people's culture, they try to share the faith with them. And I don't know how much success you can have doing it that way, but whatever the case, they really befriended in one country these Buddhist monks, who then allowed them to go into the inner sanctum of their temple, and it was like a maze, and it was like art, but it was like graffiti. It was on the walls, and the further they got, and it was like, you know, going to the Holy of Holies in the Buddhist sense, but the further they got, the more wicked and vile it looked, until eventually the final stage was like paintings on the wall of people, naked people in horrible torment and in flames. It looked like, you know, a slideshow of hell. And they were talking about how, you know, Buddhism on the outside seems so nice and so peaceful, but when you get to the deeper secrets of it, it's got an incredibly ugly side. I've been told, by the way, same thing from Mormons in the temple, that, you know, starts out looking real Christian, but once you get into the Mormon temple and you get initiated into some of its secrets, there seems to be a very big occultic side that that often gets overlooked. So, you know, the Bible says Satan disguises himself as an angel of light, and so things can look so good at first appearance, but then as we get further on, it gets worse and worse. So the Four Noble Truths, Buddha said that life is filled with suffering, the existence of suffering. The cause of suffering is our desires for pleasures of the senses. By the way, Buddhism promises the cessation of all desires. Christianity is the exact opposite. King David said, Psalm 37:4, delight yourself in the Lord, and he'll give you the desires of your heart. So make the Lord your greatest joy, and then God will give you whatever you desire. Now, to these heretics on television, they think, oh, make the Lord my greatest joy, and then I can name and claim a Corvette in Jesus' name. No, if the Lord's your greatest joy, you're probably not going to be naming and claiming Corvettes in Jesus' name. Okay? If you make the Lord your greatest joy, God will change your desires so that you'll begin to desire what he desires for you. And so an awful lot of the things that we desire are just plain sin. Make the Lord your greatest joy, and that selfish sinfulness will be chipped away. Our hardened hearts will be chipped away, and eventually we'll begin to desire what God desires for us. But whatever the case, the existence of suffering, the cause of suffering is our desire for pleasures of the senses, for them to be met. We can extinguish our desiring, and this will end suffering, and we can extinguish our desiring through the Eightfold Path. Now, you know, Buddhist writings are in different languages, and it's always hard to get a translation, so you're going to have the Eightfold Path defined in different ways, but I'll just give you the best way that I understand them. First off, you got to have the right views. Well, the right views are the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Paths. Then you have to have the right attitude. Renounce pleasure and harm no one. So it's kind of like there's no such thing as right and wrong, but there's a whole lot of moral rights that they promote and moral wrongs that they tell you to avoid. So right attitude, renounce pleasure and hate no one, harm no one. You know, I told you about that girl. I think I told this class about that. After I spoke at Olympic College, I had lunch with a whole bunch of students, and there was this little gal telling me, she said, well, I'm not Christian, I'm a Buddhist. And we were in the cafeteria, you know, me and Pastor Gordy and some Christians and a bunch of non-Christians, and she's sitting down there with a pile of food like this much on her plate, and I don't know what kind of metabolism she had, but if I ate that much food each day, I'd be a lot bigger in a bad way than I am now. But she said, I'm a Buddhist. And I said, no, you're not. And she said, yes, I am. I said, well, then you're not a good one. She said, yes, I am. And I said, no, you're not. I said, look at all the desire that's on your plate. And she didn't know what I was talking about. And so I was just like, wow, this is a lousy Buddhist. It just, you know, I was just an American kid who heard the word Buddhism and thought, okay, I want to be radical. I want to be different. All these young people, they want to be radical. They want to be different. So what do? They follow the crowd like everybody else. You want to be radical, you want to be different. No more radical thing than you can do right now is sell out for Jesus. And but renouncing a pleasure. When I worked with the sub-base police department at Bangor after I got out of the Marine Corps, they had nuclear components for nuclear weapons being shipped through to Bangor through a white train. And the protesters would come out there, and they'd always make me the arresting officer because it was going to be on television. It was going to be, as a former Marine, I knew how to wear a uniform. They liked the way I spoke. It sounded authoritative. You know, I was lifting weights heavy. So I was going to be the one who was going to show up on the television shows, the news shows. My photo was going to be in the newspapers. And I was going to have to go to court. You got to send one guy to court. You know, I might arrest 22 people. So other guys are cuffing them, not me, but I'm reading them all their rights. And then I got to spend a week in court so that half the department doesn't have to go. And so I was telling the guys who to cuff and this and that. But there had been this Buddhist monk that had been there, you know, bald head, loose clothing, just pounding a drum, just boom, 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 you know, over and over again for years. Well, one year the Buddhist monk decided to sit on the tracks and wouldn't move. So we had to move the Buddhist monk, put the Buddhist monk against the bus that we were going to, you know, cuff everybody and then take him away. We had to cuff him because it'd be too easy for terrorists to sneak in with the peaceful protesters. And if we didn't cuff them, all the terrorists would get us. So we got to pat them all down and all. So I had one of my officers, I think it was Officer Craig Long, told him to, you know, pat the guy down. So he started patting him, pat it down one arm, the other arm. Then he hit the chest and he stepped back and he said, Fernandez, we need a female officer out here real quick. And I was like, you're kidding. He's like, no. No makeup, shaved head, loose clothing. We thought it was a Buddhist monk all that time, for years. We thought it was a Buddhist monk, it was a Buddhist nun. That's, disagree with her, but that's a serious Buddhist. Not some girl wearing a whole lot of makeup and expensive clothing and then putting a whole mound of food on her plate and calling herself a Buddhist, okay? And so you got to renounce pleasure. Right speech, no lies, slander, or idle talk. Right behavior, don't kill any creature, no unlawful sex. I remember when Dalai Lama spoke out against homosexuality, and the media was shocked, you know. Our idol is not politically correct in this area. And right occupation, earn a living that harms no one. I can remember when I was arresting these people, they'd quote verses out of context. Like one lady, I was arresting her, and I cuffed her and was taking her to be processed. And she said, Officer Fernandez, they knew nothing about the military, so they usually called me, what was it, Commander Fernandez or something. They'd give me Navy titles, and I was like, I'm a civilian police department. Just call me Officer Fernandez. And they do it in court, too, when I did it, because a lot of them would represent themselves. It was just like an embarrassment, you know. But she quoted from 1 Samuel, and she said, oh, I heard you're a preacher. The battle is the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. I said, you know who you're quoting? And she was like, well, it's from the Bible. I said, yeah, but who is the Bible quoting there? She said, I don't know. And I said, he's quoting from a shepherd boy named David. And that was just minutes before he embedded a rock in a Philistine giant's forehead. And then he took the giant's sword and cut his head off. So whatever he meant when he said the battle is the Lord's, I don't think he meant the same thing you mean by it. You know, because she thought the battle is the Lord, so we never fight. David was the battle is the Lord's, so he's going to give me the victory. I'm going to go kill a giant today. So if anything, that passage in its proper context is, that means we can go, defeat the enemy in Jesus' name. That has a whole different context than the way she was using it. And but right occupation, earn a living that harms no one. They always wanted me to become, because they took a liking to me over the years. I got to know them and all. And by the way, their occupations almost always was either unemployed or protester. So some of them would receive like a little bit of money here or there to protest for Ground Zero and stuff like that. Most of them lived in Canada. So they come down from Canada to protest here in America. And what did a guy... had one protester, he couldn't find Ground Zero, so he came to Bangor and I was working the gate, the main gate. And it's right up there, the Lovato Road, the bridge. So I had to get up there and go right or left. And he came asking me for directions, and I thought, man, I don't know if I'm allowed to help the enemy. And he had backpacked all the way from Canada and hitchhiked. And I figured, to get that close and not make it, that's a bummer. So I called in the office and said, hey, I got this guy here. And they say, well, if you want, just give him directions to Ground Zero. We don't care. And I said, this is America. And I said, yeah, I agree, So I gave him directions and stuff and everything. And what did he was saying how he hates America because America tells the whole world, tells other countries how to run their lives and this and that, and it's none of America's business. And so, and he's got a point there. I don't like America sticking its nose in anybody's business too. But I thought it was kind of self-refuting for what he was doing. So I said, so wait a minute, let me get this right. You're coming all the way from Canada to tell America how to run its business, and then you don't like America because America tells other countries how to run their business. But whatever the case, I gave him the directions, and he got together for his little powwow. Also, right effort, strive to acquire good qualities and perfection, whatever that means. Right mindfulness, be alert, contemplative, free of desire and sorrow. Sorrow, it's kind of like not just desires, but it's all passions. You don't want to have any passions at all. So I mean, a good Buddhist will not only not desire things, but shouldn't show a whole lot of emotion. So I think even Dalai Lama was, he smiled way too much. And and they seem like such nice people, and this and that and blah, and it's like, you're not really supposed to be nice. You're getting a little bit too passionately, emotionally involved here. But even sorrow, you're supposed to get to the point where, your father dies or your spouse dies, and you're not even supposed to show emotion. So, right mind. So, right. It's kind of like their idea. Right mindfulness is to totally turn off the mind. And by the way, I saw. And this might sound like it doesn't have anything to do with what we're talking about, but it has everything to do with what we're talking about. A video of those. I think it's in Oregon. Some kind of a big mega church. That's really big on, it's either Northern California or Oregon, but it's really big on just the kind of the Rodney Howard Brown, just experience God with what the Hindus call bhakti. Laughing, barking, slaying the spirit, these guys are real big into that. And so there's this street preacher who was not doing things the way I would, at least he was preaching the gospel. But he's just shouting at people and quoting scriptures. I don't think that's worked since maybe 1785. So I think it's a little outdated. But the average American doesn't want to be preached at. But they have an opinion about everything. So asking people questions and getting them into religious discussion and dialogue, I think, is a better way to share the gospel message. By the way, he was a street preacher doing that. And here, you'd think these would be atheists, but these are Christians telling, and so this girl's laughing and kind of floating around, and she's like, you'd think she was on some kind of powerful drugs. And she's saying, no, man, no, it's Jesus, it's just Jesus. And she was saying, Jesus doesn't care about what you believe. He doesn't care about theology, you know, and she was just floating back and forth, and her buddy was like, oh, dude, man, you know. They were even dressed like hippies, but this guy posted it, the video, because these are the kinds of people that are being produced in that particular church, where it's kind of like hyper-Pentecostalism, not Pentecostalism, but hyper-Pentecostalism on steroids. And Bhagwan Rajneesh, I remember watching a video there where his people would stand for their meditation and bounce up and down. And then the video clips would skip like every 30 minutes or so, because they'd be doing it for 8 to 10 hours. And they'd just be like, you know, doing their mantras, and there'd be hundreds of them. And then one by one, they would just bounce and hit the ground. It's not like Christian slain in the spirit where they catch you. These people were serious. They just dropped to the cement floor and bounce. And then they entered the stage of uncontrollable laughing. And then a few hours later, then they're barking and growling. And then a few hours later, it sounded like the soundtrack from hell, blood-curdling screams. Well, the Hindus have been doing that kind of thing for centuries, and it's called bhakti. That's their devotion. And now we're doing that in the church. And in fact, one of the guy that was with the girl was doing a headstand, some kind of yoga position, for most of the discussion, and then he came down and came over. And I'm telling you, American Christianity barely has a pulse right now. And but there's an example of that mindfulness, alert, being alert and contemplative, but then free of desire and sorrow. That's almost contradictory there, because the only way to really be free of desire and sorrow, you end up becoming, I think, non-alert. You become like incoherent and almost unconscious. And Tal Brook was the leading Western disciple of Sai Baba, a power guru in India, a Hindu. But he said that many of the power gurus live in a perpetual trance-like state. Sri Chimnoy was the chaplain at the United Nations meditation room. You couldn't get a picture of this guy with his pupils. He was just constantly, you know, in such almost like a drunken stupor, just from his meditation. Guy wasn't even doing drugs, but all you'd ever see is like his eyes half shut and the whites of his eyes. And but if you want to see the ugly side of Hinduism and Eastern thought, try to read some of Tal Brook's books. And but whatever the case, so write mindfulness, and then write, so all the normal human emotions of joy, desire, sorrow, you're supposed to get rid of those. So it's like, Blake, you're talking about, well, why not just take all these drugs and just do it that way? And that's what Timothy Leary said. We're at Harvard, and whereas his buddy said, no, I'm going to go to India and be a guru, became Ram Dass. And they shared their notes, and it was the same thing. But it's kind of like God created us in His image, and Buddhism, by trying to put out the flame of desire, in the end, it's just a total dehumanizing process, to where, you know, at the end of this, if they were successful at this, at the end, you'd have more in common with a tree than you would with another human being. And then right meditation, they have 4 degrees of meditation after desires are gone, so it just goes on and on. So, further Buddhist teachings, nirvana is a blowing out of the flame of desire, a state of peace and bliss. It's the final goal of Buddhism, yet it cannot be expressed adequately in words. Five precepts all Buddhists must follow. One, kill no living thing, not even insects. So you don't even, I suppose they don't describe, they're not defining a living thing as plant life, because then they'd be killing plants even if they're vegetarians. But let's see Americans follow this if they claim they're Buddhist. But kill no living thing, not even insects. But by the way, Dalai Lama couldn't do that. I was going back and forth between Billy Graham. It was alive Billy Graham preaching late in his life on one station. And then on the next station, it was Dalai Lama being interviewed. I went back and forth. And on one station, you were hearing the gospel message, the good news of salvation through Jesus. And on the other thing, there was this bug flying around Dalai Lama's head. And he eventually went like that, just hit it. And the guy said, I noticed you hit that. You're, as a Buddhist, you're not supposed to. He said, the first time I let it take some blood. The second time, I gently blow it away. But by the third time, and it's just like, dude, you're supposed to be the man when it comes to Buddhism. And if you still can't, if you're still bothered by insects, and you're not supposed to kill any of them, and you're doing it, what does that tell you about your religion? So no killing no living thing, no stealing, no adultery, no lies, no drinking or taking drugs. By the way, portions of these sound a whole lot like the Ten Commandments, so there's an element of truth there. But, in the cessation of desire and the denial of absolute truth and denial of absolute morality, they sure do bring back. I mean, Hindus and Buddhists will march to try to make the world a better place. Where does that fit with their view of either no God or a non-personal God? Now, there's five additional precepts that Buddhist monks and nuns must follow. Eat moderately and try not to eat fancy food. Avoid excitement. There's a good one. We got Americans right now, young Americans, they call themselves Buddhist and they play video games. Okay? They get mad at their parents if their parents make them do something boring. We're supposed to eat moderately, avoid excitement, no wearing adornments or perfume. Remember that Buddhist nun who's to the point we thought it was a guy. And shaved head, no makeup, no perfume, and clothing that totally covered the shape of her body so that we thought it was a he. No sleeping in luxurious beds. Usually it's just a mat on a cement floor or just on a cement floor itself. Accepting no silver or gold. Another Buddhist teaching, the universe has evolved, it was not created, so it just goes through different stages, kind of like the oscillating model of the universe, where you have supposedly an infinite number of Big Bangs, which is violates philosophy and science. And then reincarnation, unsatisfied desire is the cause of rebirth. So once you stop desiring, then you attain to attain nirvana. There's two popular forms of Buddhism. Nichiren Shashu Buddhism, a Japanese mystical sect. It's been revived in the last 50 to 60 years. It was named after its founder, a reformer, Japanese reformer from the 13th century A.D. They accepted writings that are the Lotus Sutra, written between 200 B.C. and 200 A.D. And they have this real weird view of this black wooden box, the Gohanzen, that contains the name of persons in the Lotus Sutra. The accepted writings again, and it forces control of devotees' lives. And these guys have a missionary emphasis. Not all Buddhists do, so they desire to convert the world. So what you find over the years, over the centuries, a lot of Buddhist groups have added an awful lot of superstitious type beliefs. Now, the most widely known form of Buddhism in the United States is Zen Buddhism. It's a branch of Mahayana Buddhism from China and Japan. They have no sacred literature. So, you know, again, the emphasis on experience. But they do have teachings that are transmitted from mind to mind, but not explained in words. This developed 1,000 years after Buddha died. Has Buddha's emphasis on meditation. They tell their disciples, look within, you are the Buddha. In Zen meditation, you get in the sitting position and there's chanting. You're given a koan, K-O-A-N, a verbal puzzle given by a Zen master to his pupil to increase the pupil's self-awareness. Like they'll tell you, they'll ask you to meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. You know, things like that to kind of try to disengage the mind. So you try to think about nonsensical, irrational things. You can reach sudden enlightenment in Zen Buddhism. It's called Satori. It cannot be communicated. Words cannot describe Zen. And the followers lose their ability to think logically and critically. There's an inward focus, a self-authenticating subjective experience. See, just because you had a religious experience doesn't mean it was true. You got to test that experience to see whether it was true or not. And that's why John tells us in 1 John chapter 4, verse 1, test the spirits to see if they're from God, for not all spirits are from God. And the way you test them is their view of Christ. And so Christian response, the goal of meditation is to lose one's identity. So you want to lose all self-consciousness, all desire, all passion. It's described in a very similar way to the way nothingness would be described. Okay? So, I mean, if people want that, you know, it's just like, let me read Jeremiah 2:13. Because I think that really applies here. Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 13. The Lord says this, for my people, the Jewish people, have committed two evils. The first one, they have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters. And the second one, and hewn or made for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. So Jeremiah, the Lord is saying through Jeremiah, you have rejected me, the true living waters that can quench your thirst for God, and instead you built cisterns, even broken cisterns that can hold no water. Now in the land of Israel, there is so little fresh water, so there's not a whole lot of wells. And to get from one well to another well, if you're stuck in between, you can dehydrate. And so what the Jews would do in ancient times, they would chip out of stone a container that would collect rainwater. But then bugs would get in there, dirt would get in there. And so what they would do then is put a lid over it and have drain pipes. But you would still get bugs and dirt in there. So they'd put a screen over the drain pipes. But no matter how hard they tried, the water still stunk. This, by the way, is probably one of the leading reasons why they mixed wine. The Jews define wine as one part, in the Talmud, one part wine and three parts water. Strong drink was one part wine, one part water. And then if you drank straight wine, they considered you a barbarian. But the alcohol of the wine killed a lot of the germs that could kill you. and then gave a little bit of flavor to that nasty water. But that's the kind of water the people would drink. But that's if the cistern is not broken. If the cistern has cracks, it can't hold any water. So we got two guys. Usually the translations say they were thrown into a pit. But Joseph's brothers, when they beat him up, they tossed him into a broken cistern. And then Jeremiah himself got tossed into a broken cistern. So a broken cistern which can hold no water can't even temporarily quench our thirst. Rather than like a stream of living water which can perpetually quench our thirst. Or God who can eternally quench our thirst. A broken cistern can't even temporarily quench your thirst. All it can do is imprison you. That's all it's good for. And you know, that's what we see in America, in the American love fest with Buddhism. We're rejecting Jesus, the fountain of living water, and instead we're turning to broken cisterns which can hold no water. Say, yeah, I love Buddhism, and I really, what a great goal, to lose one's identity. And, you know, it's just like, you know, what you have with the world religions that reject Jesus, you have people working real hard to go to hell. And it comes natural to us. I mean, you just stay in bed and go to hell. But it just amazes me that people will work so hard and think so hard about going to hell, which would have been a real easy thing to do. But the Christian response to Buddhism, you know, the idea of monism, all reality is one. Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So you have a creator, and then you have his creation, and he created many things in his creation. The rejection of a personal God, biblical Christianity teaches that God is a God who can love us. He loved us so much he sent his son to die on the cross for us, even when we were his enemies. John 3:16 and Romans 5:8. The Buddhist believes there's no such thing as sin. That contradicts Romans 6:23 and the whole Bible for that matter. We fell in the garden, Genesis 3. They deny Jesus' deity. Buddhism denies salvation through Jesus alone. And then their denial of absolute truth, reason, and absolute morality also falls by the wayside. Now, if you just turn the page there, we don't really have time to get into it, but you could look at some of the other religions. Jainism is one of the three great religions that came out of Hinduism: Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism. Turn the page there, and then you just read the notes on Sikhism, and then Taoism, a Chinese religion with the Lao Tzu and the Yin and the Yang. Shintoism, once the national religion of Japan, one of the world's oldest religions. Big emphasis on ancestor, reverence of ancestors. Zoroastrianism, we talked a little bit about that earlier. Confucianism in China, which is more a way of life. At the same time, it holds a religious... it's treated as a religion. And then the Baha'i faith. What's interesting is that Judaism Christianity says it's the fulfillment of Judaism, and it is. Messiah has come. But Islam says that it's the fulfillment of Christianity, that Muhammad is the other helper that was promised to come. Well, let me tell you, look, God in former times, Hebrews 1:1-3, God in former times spoke to us in many ways. Through the prophets, through angels, through visions and dreams. But in these last days, he has spoken to us through his Son, who is the exact representation of his nature, because he's God incarnate. It doesn't get better than Jesus. That's why Paul could say, for in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you are made complete. So anybody who says we're going to improve on Christianity, you can't. You can't improve on God. Okay? And like Muhammad Ali died recently. He called himself the greatest. No, Jesus is the greatest. And you can't be any greater. You can't be greater than the greatest. And so Islam, to say that it's the fulfillment of it, is just baloney. Okay? And it just really comes down to salvation by works and devotion to some probably high-ranking demon who calls himself Allah, masquerades himself as the creator God, but is actually closer to Shiva of Hinduism, the destroyer. And hence the Islamic terrorism. But the Baha'i faith claims to be the fulfillment of Islam, okay? And it's gained many, many adherents, but they also believe that all religions lead to God. So, and then there's just the New Age movement, and if we have a course in philosophy of religion someday, if I'm able to teach that, we'll be able to go over secular humanism and atheism and arguments for God's existence, and that's really my specialty. Maybe one of these days we'll be able to have a course in non-Christian cults and the occult and the New Age movement and Wicca, modern witchcraft. But what I'm going to do, we're going to take a break for about 10 minutes, and then I'll just close out the time with a discussion on the future of religion. And hopefully I've got some insights into what's going on. Religious circles, political circles, and hopefully we'll get have a little discussion about that. If we have any time left, we can do Q&A or whatever. But let's take about a 12-minute break, and we come back at